Welcome to the Forency Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Soren. Forency is a podcast about Near Eastern history, language, and culture, and is brought to you by Forency.us, the premier language learning website for intermediate to advanced learners of Arabic, Hebrew, and Russian. In this episode of the podcast, we spoke to Professor David Ilan, who serves as the director of the Nelson Gluck School of Biblical Archaeology at the Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem, and the director of the Tel Dan excavations. Our discussion focused on Professor Ilan's new theory surrounding the emergence of Israel and Canaan. I had a great time talking with him, and I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Great to be here.
So I reached out to you not too long ago because I saw a lecture that you gave at the Oriental Institute, part of the University of Chicago, a while back on the emergence of ancient Israel and Canaan. And you proposed a really interesting thesis explaining the origins of Israel and Canaan, or at least the rapid emergence of what are now known as Israelite settlements in the hill country, which I found to be really compelling and new. And it wasn't something that I had heard before. And that's what we're going to be diving into today. But before we do, I would like if you can set the stage for people listening by explaining what was going on in the Levant at that time.
Okay, so in the southern part of the Levant, Egypt controls everything. They're the empire. And that goes up to what is today the northern border of Lebanon, Syria. And to the north of Egypt's empire, there is another empire, which is the Hittite Empire, which is based in Anatolia, Turkey of today. There are other empires, one of them being the Mycenaean Empire, which is what is Greece today in the Greek islands. And then you would have further to the east, the Mitanni Empire, which was in what is now sort of Kurdistan and Iraq, Iran. And those are the big players in the area. The real competitor with Egypt at this time are the Hittites. And there are border conflicts, there is diplomacy, there is all kinds of subterfuge trying to bring over small city-states and their rulers to their side, lots of spying, treaties. All of this culminates in a big war that takes place circa 1270 BC, which is the Battle of Kadesh. And this battle, victory is claimed by both sides. There are texts in Hittite in the capital, Bogoskoy, Hattusha, in Turkey, where the Hittites say, "We won this war." In Egypt, there are at least three texts that have also a depiction of the battle and the treaty that is culminated and signed afterwards, where the Egyptians claim that they were victorious. But from the two different treaty texts that we have on both sides, it's very clear that it was pretty much a standoff, that nobody really won. And the good result of this was a treaty where they agreed upon spheres of influence and also exchange of wives and commercial ties and ambassadors. And this was good for both sides. And from that point onwards, things were safer for both parties. And this is the sort of overall background of what's going on at the time. And once the war is won, Egypt can turn its attention a little bit more inwards towards its own territories and towards the area of Syria and what is now Israel, Palestine, Jordan, and solidify and consolidate its control.
Just a little geography lesson of the hill country in what's today Israel, what was then considered Canaan. Can you give us an overview of where that is and what that looked like at this time?
So today, of course, everything is so much closer and we have vehicles and you have flights and everything's shorter and closer. In antiquity, the hill country of Israel, the deserts of Israel, the deserts of Jordan and Arabia were hinterlands. They were really far away. These were days of walking. And if you went into the hill country of Israel, for example, most of the population was settled on the coastal plain or in the fertile valleys. And the hill country was sort of this frontier. It wasn't that far, and you could walk up to the hill country in a couple hours, but it was covered by brush, by a sort of forest. Less of it was cultivated. The valley bottoms were cultivated. But different peoples lived up in the hill country, tribal peoples. There were very few permanent settlements. There were a couple. And those places were probably nominally controlled by the Egyptians, but the entire hill country was not really under their control. And we have texts that explain how the Egyptians periodically have to go up into the hill country and put down rebellions or brigands and teach people a lesson from time to time. And the hill country is a problem to be dealt with. And for a number of decades, the Egyptians couldn't quite do that. And this is the background to sort of my thesis of how they decided to do this.
Mm-hmm. And just generally speaking, why would people settle in an area like that, whether you're talking about the hill country in what's today Israel or anywhere else in the world? Why generally do people go to inhospitable areas like that?
For one thing, there always were people there. And those people, they're tribal peoples. In fact, the name of one of them is Israel. We know this from what's called the Mer Neptah Stela, an inscription that was found in Karnak in Egypt, left by the Egyptian king Mer Neptah around 1205 or so BC, where he talks about actually defeating the Israelites, probably up in the hill country, and decimating them, which was a bit of hyperbole. But people are there anyway. They probably never left. They didn't leave much in the way of material finds. And at the same time, this is probably a region where you can go to get away from the lowlands. So if you are in arrears of your taxes, or if you've committed some kind of crime in the eyes of the authorities, you can go up to the frontier, to the hill country, and hide out with people. You know, there are biblical stories which sort of hint at this kind of thing. So the frontiers in the hill country are also inhabited, but much less densely so, and it's a place where you can run away to.
Mm-hmm. Why have those settlements in the hill country been identified as Israelite? What makes them Israelite?
Traditionally, when we read the biblical text, particularly the books of Joshua and Judges, even Samuel to an extent, this is the heartland of Israelite activity. When the Israelites finished their sojourn of 40 years in the desert, and they cross the Jordan River at Gilgal, and then they have this mass conversion ceremony with circumcision to recreate the covenant with God. Then they go to Jericho, and they defeat Jericho, you know, with the blowing of the trumpets and the circuit seven times around the walls. Once that is carried out, they go up to the hill country. They go up to a place called Ha'ai, which interestingly enough means the ruin. And they also conquer Ha'ai, a Canaanite city, destroy it. And then they branch out and they take several directions over time and consolidate their control of the hill country. So historians and biblical scholars and the early archaeologists of the early 20th century went up to these places looking for the evidence for this sojourn and this conquest that's in the biblical text. And archaeologists have a tendency to find what they're looking for. And so when Jericho was found to be destroyed, or when Ai was destroyed, and all kinds of other places have destruction layers that could be dated more or less to the 13th or 12th century BCE, they said, okay, here it is. This is what we have in the Bible. And so these little sites that were all over the place became known as Israelite settlement sites. And there was one particular find, very prosaic find, but it was something that was found in a lot of these sites. These are fragments of a big pithos, which is a very large store jar, more than 3 feet high. And it was called a collared rim pithos because the rim was turned over to form sort of a collar. And this pithos was found in all of these little sites up in the hill country. And the archaeologists decided this was what we call a fossil director, in French, a fossil directeur, of the Israelite settlement culture. And from that point onwards, it became sort of a circular argument. Wherever you find these things, that's Israelite settlement, right? Mm-hmm. So this is what people were looking for. This is why it became sort of a truism that when you find these small villages with collared rim jars, this is evidence for Israelite settlement.
Can you talk about some of the other characteristics of those settlements, whether it be the houses or any evidence we have of ritual cult?
The houses and the settlements themselves are very small. They're like homesteads. They're little farms or small villages. Sometimes they'll have sort of a corral wall around them, and then you'll have two or three or four houses, sometimes up to as many as seven or eight. Some of them have a sort of archetypal kind of plan. It's what we call a four-room house, where there are three sort of longitudinal rooms, and then there's a transversal back room. A lot of times the longitudinal rooms are divided at least in one place by columns that supported a second, an upper floor. These are usually two-story buildings. And the idea was always that the lower floor was for animals, especially in the winter, to keep them safe and to not have them stolen. And the upstairs was sort of for sleeping and for other activities. You find these in a number of these sites, and this is the first period when you find these kinds of houses. A lot of times you find pits, for storing grain. It's a good way to keep your grain safe because there are people that want to steal your grain. So a good way to do it is bury it in the ground in a hidden way so that even if somebody comes and robs you, your grain is still hidden away. Sometimes there are cisterns. There may be terraces built for cultivation nearby the settlement. This is still a bit of an argument whether they actually were used by then or not. And most of these settlements, you know, have at most a few tens of people. Some of them have a few hundreds of people. There are a couple that are larger. And it seems like these were more sort of patriarchal households that ruled over a larger territory. And these can have, you know, 20, 30 houses, sometimes more in them, and they can be more densely occupied. So the settlement array is, you know, sort of a hierarchical one that looks something like that. There are also towns here and there. Hebron is a town. Shechem is a town in the area of Samaria. Jerusalem was a town. We don't know exactly who rule or control these towns. I would say that part of the time it's the Egyptians. There's evidence for that. Maybe local polities that originally control a territory. The idea was that these smaller settlements are a new thing and that they are something that's sort of imposed on the landscape and they are maybe at odds with the larger towns. Another proposition is that a lot of these towns actually would have been abandoned at this time, at the same time when the smaller settlements appear. And I think that's still a question that we still have to work with because our chronological criteria are not quite clear yet.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of any kind of evidence of a ritual cult or religion or things like that, what do we see in those sites?
First of all, very little. There's very little of the iconism, the iconic portrayals of gods and deities and things that you have in the late Bronze Age down in the lowlands. I'm suggesting that this material culture that we have in the highlands is pretty much contemporaneous with what we have in the lowlands. There's something different about it. You don't have that much iconography. There are a couple of things. So there was one site called the Bull Site that was found and published by Amichai Mazar, I think back in the 80s, where you have a bull, a bronze bull. It looks like a zebu bull. And it was thought that maybe this is an attribute of the Israelites' deity. Maybe it's the symbol of El, for example, the main chief god of the Canaanite pantheon, who later becomes the only god and is seen as the same as Yahweh. Yahweh is a more southern god, and El is the northern god. And at some point in time, there's what we call a syncretism, where these two become one. And that's why in the biblical text that we have now, God can be referred to as El, Elohim, or Yahweh. And sometimes they're even put together with a hyphen. So there's something going on here with a bull. And at the same time, there's very little iconism. At Ai, there was a stand that was found, a cultic stand with windows in it. It's about a few feet high. And there are what look like feet sticking out of it, appended to it, made of clay. But you have no faces, no animals. It's just feet. I would suggest that might be the feet of the deity. Maybe, it's El. But as I said, there's very, very little portrayal of deity. And here we can see what is probably maybe the beginnings of the second commandment, where there is a prohibition of portraying the deity, at least among certain sectors of the population.
And then in terms of animal consumption that would have been there and how that worked into any kind of connection with the Israelites, can you speak on that?
Yes. So there is clearly a pork taboo in place. They're not eating pigs. There's very little pork bones in the animal bone assemblage. Now, one of the problems with that is that because the pork taboo exists in the Hebrew Bible, then as soon as there are no pig bones, then you say, okay, these are Israelites. But the thing is that in many societies of the ancient Near East, especially nomadic societies, but also peasant societies, small-scale societies, pigs were shunned. And it was more of an economic reason because pigs, they exist in the wild. The hill country of Israel is a fine place for pigs to flourish. They need some water, but there are lots of springs. But people that have flocks or small farmers that have small plots don't like pigs because pigs get out of their pens, they destroy crops. And for these people, their crops were more important than an extra source of protein. They had plenty of sheep and goat meat and even cattle meat because they were using a plow and the cows got old, you slaughtered them, you could eat them. They did not really need the pork meat, and the pigs don't provide any secondary products. You don't get wool or milk from pigs, only meat, and they're destructive. So a lot of societies in the Levant did not have pigs and tried to keep them away. Of course, the Philistines, when they came, they brought with them pigs, probably from Greece and from the islands, because it was a very accessible form of protein. You could come off the boat very quickly. You had a herd of pigs that you would maintain inside your pens, and very quickly you have plenty of protein. Whereas sheep and goats and even cattle take longer to develop herds, besides which they came with a developed taste for pork, and they kept that. That was one of their cultural attributes. Later on, the rejection of pigs also became synonymous with the rejection of Philistines and everything that was Philistine.
We'll get into this in a bit, but just to keep people balanced with everything going on with the geography at this point. So you have these Israelite settlements in the hill country, and then you have Philistine settlements, Sea People settlements on the coast, correct?
Yeah, right. More the southern coast. The northern coast is a bit of a different story.
So I want to go back to the Menepta Stele or Stele, and why it's important for the discussion of the emergence or existence of an entity or a people called Israel at that time. So what can historians and archaeologists infer about the characteristics of this group?
We actually have very little information about who these people are. In the Stele, when you have the word Israel, the Egyptian language has, hieroglyphics have what we call a determinative, which tells us what kind of word it is. And the determinative for the word Israel is a people. There's a man and a woman and three lines underneath those. So we know that it's a group of people, but we don't know if it's a small tribe of 300 people or if it's a large nation of 30,000 people. We just don't know. From the location of the name Israel in the Menepta Stele, it seems that group of people would have to be located somewhere in the central part of the country. It comes after certain names and it comes before other names. And Menepta's expedition, it progresses in geographical sequence. So Israel should be somewhere in the middle of the country. So there's a group of people, we don't know how large it is, somewhere in the middle of the country, we don't know exactly where, and that's all we can say.
But at the same time, it made the cut, right? So it made the cut of who an Egyptian pharaoh decided to mention. So what does that tell us about who they were in relation to the Egyptians? Were they hostile? What was going on there?
That's actually a very good question. And you're right. You're absolutely right. If their name is mentioned in a stele, that means that they were forced to be reckoned with, somebody that needed to be dealt with. And the Egyptians claim that they did so. In fact, their seed is no more, which was obviously an exaggeration because their seed continued. And we hear about Israel as a kingdom hundreds of years after that. But it was important for the Egyptians, from a propagandistic point of view, to let the readers of the stele know that they had dealt with the Israelites. So yes, they were an important force. Probably not 300 people, probably closer to a few thousand, and probably very dangerous from a military rebellion point of view.
And just some historical background on the Menepta Stone. When was that found, and why is it so important, archaeologically speaking?
It was found in the late 19th century, I believe, by William Flinders Petrie and one of his expeditions in the central Egypt in the Karnak area. Petrie was the father of modern scientific archaeology, and he introduced stratigraphy and typology to the whole enterprise. He, for years afterwards, claimed that was his most important find. He also came from a sort of fundamentalist, Brethren Christian background who believed that Jews would convert at the end of days when the Messiah would return. And for him, this mention of Israel in this ancient Egyptian document was a fantastic find. We've known about this thing very early on. It's when you enter the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, it's like the first thing that you see when you enter. They also recognize its value as a tourist magnet and its historical importance. It was carved and placed in the Merneptah's mortuary temple circa 1205 BCE, when this is in the time of the 19th dynasty, a very powerful. Merneptah is the successor to Ramses II. He's inheriting this very large, very efficient, very powerful empire, which is starting to develop problems throughout its limitations. Rebellions in small places all around it, and the need to put down these rebellions. And there's also internal strife. There are different factions within Egypt, different religious organizations, the Amun priesthood, the aristocracy. They're all jockeying for power. And especially when Ramses II dies, this stuff gains force. Merneptah is dealing with problems inside and outside of the empire. So he needs to tell everybody, I defeated all these problematic enemies up north. I'm back. I'm a force to be reckoned with myself.
So when his, would you call it a raid or an invasion or into Canaan? How would you describe it?
This was not so much a raid, and it's not an invasion per se, because nominally, at least, Egypt controls Canaan. This is a punitive expedition, and it's also a very serious attempt to put down rebellion in a number of places. I mean, they have to go into Ashkelon and destroy Ashkelon. Ashkelon was an Egyptian center. They've lost control of Ashkelon. That's a big problem. This is serious. It's a real military expedition that was launched out of their capital's delta, in the Egyptian delta, a large army that was there for months and months. And that large army also had to live off of land when the Egyptian centers were no longer functioning as victualling points for the Egyptian army. So this was serious business with huge logistic issues.
Is this happening before or after the emergence of these settlements in the hill country?
I'm pretty sure that the settlements are already in place, at least some of them. A lot more are established afterwards. And it's a fairly complex process, and you can't attribute all of them, in my view, just to one factor. There are different people or groups of people who are settling for different reasons, but as you're getting at, I think, I'm claiming that some of the very first of these small farmsteads are actually instigated by the Egyptians themselves. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go back now to something you touched on in the beginning, which was the Battle of Kadesh, and it works into the broader geopolitical scene at the time, which was around the Bronze Age collapse, so around 1200 BC-ish. And we had Eric Klein on, Professor Eric Klein on the previous podcast to discuss his book, 1177, on the general Bronze Age collapse. But to go back to the Battle of Kadesh and what was going on in the Levant at that time, how did that battle set the stage for future Egyptian control or influence over that region?
So as I said, I think that it's fair to say that once the Battle of Kadesh was finished and the treaty was signed, Egypt didn't have to worry so much about its northern frontier. It could focus its attention on what was happening in Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Jordan. And as we said, there were issues there. Now, because Ramses II was this tremendously powerful king, he had the wherewithal to really consolidate his forces and to make sure that everything was in place. And the thing that he did was establish fortresses and administrative centers in a much more dense pattern than was there before. He probably started this system before the Battle of Kadesh, but he certainly increased its density and intensity afterwards. And so instead of having a couple of centers, Gaza, Jaffa, Beit Sha'an, and maybe that's it, he established tens of centers throughout the, especially the lowlands, and even in places like Jerusalem, there was certainly an Egyptian presence. Places like Tel Dan, Beit Sha'an was made larger. Megiddo was probably taken over. Tel Abu Hawan near Haifa. They established tens of fortresses and governor's residencies throughout the country in places that your listeners probably never heard of even. One of the characteristics of these residencies is a particular kind of building that looks quite Egyptian in its layout. It has a couple of courtyards and lots of storage rooms arrayed around it. It's usually a multi-story building. And this is where the governor resided, probably. We find scarab seals and things like that. Other evidence of Egyptian pottery making or importation of Egyptian goods. And this was an inundation of Egyptian control. It's sort of parallel to what the American army did in Iraq in the 1990s, what you would call today the Petraeus Doctrine, where at first you had the army concentrated in a few places, like in the Green Zone in Baghdad, and it was constantly being attacked, and America had lost control of the countryside. And Petraeus said, this is not working. Let's establish a whole bunch of smaller control centers in places like Fallujah and other towns all around throughout Iraq, and project our presence and patrol everywhere. and make alliances with local chieftains, warlords, and things like that. Try to make the economy work better. Try to win hearts and minds. To an extent, this was also done in Afghanistan. And at least in the short term, this doctrine worked in Iraq. It also probably worked in southern Levant. And these settlements also made connection. The Egyptian control centers connected with local populations. The only thing is, the Egyptians themselves probably had trouble recruiting Egyptians to do this work. And so what they did is they recruited foreigners. And, you know, there were lots of foreigners all over the place, Greeks, Mycenaeans, Cretans, Libyans, Nubians, Syrians, Hittites, that, let's say you had a family and you had three boys, and only the oldest son can inherit land. What do the other two do? They can be a subordinate to the oldest son, but not every boy wants to do that. And so one of the options was to either join the army of your local ruler, or if you hear about the Egyptians offering payment for service, you might say, I'm going to go serve them. Because you might have heard, for example, that the Egyptians did what the Romans did 2,000 years later, a little bit less, 1,500 years later, where they said, if you serve in the army in a frontier zone for X number of years, say 20 years, in the end, you get paid by a parcel of land. You'll get, let's say, 20 acres, 40 acres in the frontier area. We will provide you with seed to start your farm. We'll help you build. We'll provide you with wine to begin with. We'll help you get started. You and your family will be our eyes and ears in the frontier zones. If we need you, we will call you. If you need us, you can call us. And this was another way of projecting power in difficult areas. Mm-hmm. Now, part of the background to this is also that these foreigners, these Greeks, these Hittites, these Syrians that served the Egyptian army in these foreign places, they were not mercenaries. They were professional soldiers who were in it for the long term and planned to stay in their new homeland. And as part of that, they hooked up with local women. You can imagine that for local tribespeople, it would be a good thing to have a connection with the Egyptian control center that was nearby. Then you felt protected. If foreigners or a neighbor tried to steal your land or steal your crops, you put in a call to the Egyptian governor's residency. He would send out some soldiers to find out who was guilty and to get your stuff back for you. And one of the ways to do that is have your daughter marry, let's say, that Philistine or that Danuna soldier who served in the Egyptian center.
Mm-hmm. How do we see this in the material culture of these sites that you're describing, these Egyptian outposts or administrative centers? What do we find there in terms of pottery or coffins or other evidence of material culture that supports this theory?
For one thing, for example, let's say in the area of Beit Shan or at Lachish, you have Egyptian-style coffins, but some of them have non-Egyptian characteristics. Like you'll have an Egyptian coffin, but the headdress is a Philistine coffin. And so the idea is probably this is somebody who's a Philistine who has been buried in the Egyptian way. And there's sort of a hybridization going on there. My colleagues, Aaron Mayer and Louise Hitchcock, who dig at the Philistine Gap, have presented this whole theory about how hybridization becomes the rule of the day, where different ethnic groups with their material culture attributes mingle and create actually something new. So you have the coffins in sites that are later called Philistine sites. The next phase after the Egyptian control phase, maybe still at the beginning of the Egyptian control phase, you have, for example, Aegean-style cooking pots together with the local cooking pots. At Tel Dan, we have figurines that are of the Ashdoda goddess-type figurines. Mostly we have just their heads. We have three of them. You have all these different little things that show that there are different people living in one site. At Tel Dan, we have lots of Egyptian cooking pots, which is more than anybody else has, which is sort of strange. You also have practice arrowheads made out of bone that are very common in Egypt during this time. We have an Egyptian razor blade, probably for haircuts, which is very typically Egyptian, that you would expect to find, say, with an Egyptian soldier, together with the Aegean-style goddess figurines, together with Canaanite-style standing stones, single standing stones in some of the rooms, together with Canaanite-style cooking pots together with the Egyptian-style cooking pots. And it's sort of all mixed together in the same place. Sometimes you can see neighborhoods that are more one thing than the other.
Interesting. I guess kind of the reinforcement of these professional soldiers that are coming now to these Egyptian administrative centers and forts, does that match up with what the situation we're seeing in the Meneptah Stone and the Meneptah Stele, where there's obviously unrest and trouble and rebellion going on in one part of that area, and there's a need to bring in soldiers?
I think that we see this phenomenon more clearly in the 12th century. In other words, just after the Meneptah Stone. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have sufficient chronological resolution in the material finds to be able to say exactly when this process begins. My guess would be that it's already in the 13th century in the period of Ramses II. Until then, we have a couple of scarab seals which seem to be Ramesside, but they could be Ramses II or they could be Ramses III or Merneptah. So they could be 13th century, but they could also be 12th century. And it's sort of difficult to pinpoint exactly when this phenomenon, this mixture, and when all these people are together at the same time. I'm pretty sure it's 13th century. There's some evidence for that. For sure, it's already in place by the 13th century. The question is whether Merneptah's expedition is some kind of turning point as far as policy goes.
Right.
And I would suggest there's more work to be done on that, more research.
Before we go deeper and actually get into the crux of your thesis and your theory, I'd like if you can touch on what have been the four or five-ish accepted theories on the emergence of ancient Israel.
Well, the earliest theory was very much Bible-centered, and it pretty much said that the story that we get from the biblical text, from Joshua, Judges, is what happened. And if things don't quite work out, then, you know, we can explain it by part of the text being written down later and mistakes being made. But the essence is that the story of Joshua's conquest of the hill country and then spreading out into the lowlands of Israel, going up north and conquering Hazor and defeating Yavin, the king of Hazor, that this is basically what happened. And there are some minor inconsistencies that we can deal with by archaeology or by explaining scribal errors and things like that. That would be the sort of William Foxwell Albright, Yigal Yadin approach. The next approach was set up by scholars like Dwight Mendenhall and Norman Gottwald, starting in the 1950s and going up to the 80s, more or less, which was sort of a Marxist approach that said that from the text itself especially, you get a sense of a rebellion, a peasant's rebellion, and that people rebelled against their Canaanite overlords who were maybe subservient to the Egyptian crown, but that this rebellion is reflected in the biblical text. Part of it took place in the lowlands, part of it took place in the highlands, and that the evidence of destruction that we're seeing in the end of the late Bronze Age and the early Iron Age is a rebellion against Canaanite overlords. The only problem is that that theory probably has very little actual archaeological support, and it's pretty much gone by the wayside. A third theory held that it's not so much a peasant's rebellion, but it is a peasant's escaping the oppression of the lowlands, of Egyptian control and Canaanite overlordship, moving up to the hill country, establishing settlements in the frontiers to get away from former overlords. And then at some point in time, these escapees, these refugees, rebel against the Egyptian crown and the Canaanites, which are attempting to bring them under control. And that this is the background to the Merneptah Stele and to the biblical text. The fourth theory is that, and this is something that was proposed mostly by Israel Finkelstein in the 1980s and 90s, is that there were always nomads living in the hill country and in the deserts, and that when things started falling apart in the 12th century BC, Ramses III and who came after, and the Egyptians left, there was chaos, and the existing system whereby nomads coexist, they live in a symbiosis with farmers that are in the lowlands, that system was no longer viable, and that the people living in the hill country had to establish themselves in permanent settlements and farm and do things that otherwise they wouldn't have done before, and that all these settlements, these small settlements in the hill country, are actually previous nomads who settled down, began to raise their own crops, build terraces, make wine, grow grapes and things like that, doing things that they couldn't do before. and that that is the explanation for the new settlements. The final theory that's actually a little bit before this one was proposed by Albrecht Alt in the 1920s, adopted by Yohanan Aharoni in the 50s and 60s, and that suggested that there actually were people who came from the outside. They came mostly from Syria and from Jordan. They crossed over the rivers, entered the land, and they didn't conquer the area first. They first settled in the Galilee, in the central hill country. And only when they were established did they then become more militaristic and start taking territory and going down into the lowlands. And that would be the fifth theory.
Those last two, primarily the fourth one, is the theory that holds the most weight now in academic circles, correct?
Yeah, I would say, I think that Finkelstein's theory took hold, the idea of previous nomads sedentarizing and then establishing themselves and then conquering various parts of the country once Egyptian and Canaanite control was dissipated. Yes, mm-hmm. I think that would be the...
Are there any characteristics of those, whether it's the houses or anything else that we discussed, that reflect any kind of nomadic culture or nomadic settlements?
Finkelstein's theory is that the four-room house that I described before is actually an embodiment of a Bedouin tent. And he wrote a couple of things where he went to the Negev and looked at the Bedouins and the way men and women are located in different places and how the tent is set up. He said, the four-room house really is like a tent. A lot of other scholars have sort of rejected that and shown why it doesn't work properly. And I also don't think it really works. I have another explanation for the four-room house, and I have a whole other explanation for how this whole process began.
I do want to hear your explanation for the four-room house, but I'll ask my other question first, and then you can throw it in wherever you like. Okay, so now I want to get into your theory, which is one that I had never heard before, and I was actually searching for. I wasn't searching for what your theory was, but I wasn't content with a lot of other lectures I had seen or theories that I had heard. And in keeping in mind everything, my personal feeling is that there's a lot of elements that probably combined into what we're looking at. It wasn't any one thing, but it was, when you're looking at the sudden and the rapid emergence of these settlements, it is a pretty strange phenomenon that happened. And a lot of people, it seems, don't want to touch it. They don't want to really go as far, I think, as you've gone, which I respect you for doing. And I think it's a really fascinating and intriguing theory, and which is why I was so taken by it. But let's get into that. So we discussed the Egyptian administrative centers that were established throughout the southern and the material culture that was there, including the pottery, which plays a key part in your theory. So let's dive into that.
Okay, so what I'm claiming is that we talked about the collard rim jar before. This very large jar, more than 3 feet high, contains about 125, 130 liters of liquids for the most part. It can be used for other things too. This was thought to be the type fossil of Israelite settlement because they're found so often in the central hill country. But what a lot of people were ignoring, and a couple people recently pointed out, is that you have large quantities of these collard rim jars in places that were Egyptian centers. So Megiddo has hundreds of them. Tel Dan has hundreds of them. There are a few at Beit Shan, a few at Lachish. It's not really just in the hill country. And the largest numbers are in these big centers. So I was beginning to think, okay, wait a second. There are so many of them in these centers, especially where I work at Tel Dan. Maybe there's another explanation here. And then it crossed my mind, and I'm looking also at the ethnic composition of these various places. It's quite clear that at Beit Shan and at Tel Dan, there are multiple ethnicities residing contemporaneously in one place. And there's also Egyptians there, and these are Egyptian centers. So it came to mind then, okay, these places are run by the Egyptians, but they're hiring foreigners who are there long-term. But wait a second, all the cooking pots, most of the cooking pots in most of these places are local Canaanite-style cooking pots. So I'm asking myself, why would that be? Who does the cooking in most traditional societies? Women. So if you have, on the one hand, local women cooking, and at the same time, you have foreigners worshiping their gods, especially at Tel Dan, and Egyptians who are cutting their hair with an Egyptian razor blade and practicing archery with bone arrowheads, what's going on here? And the idea that I came up with is that, as I said before, the professional soldiers, even some of the Egyptians, are marrying local women, they're having families, they're having kids, and then you have to ask yourself, how do these children see themselves? If their father is, let's say, Philistine, and their mother is a local Gittite woman, are they Gittite women people, or are they Philistines, or are they something new? And I came to the conclusion that a lot of times there's something new, at least two or three generations down the line. And that's when, let's say, somebody who lived at Dan and was born in that area became called a Danite, especially once the Egyptians leave circa 1140 BCE. Then that person, those families don't leave. They don't go anywhere. They stay there. Now, before that happens, when the Egyptians are still around, they adopt this inundation technique that we talked about before, where they send pioneers, veteran soldiers and their families into the hill country with the enticement of land grants. And the evidence for their victualling by the government to get them started are those collarum jars. Those collarum jars with 125, 130 liter volumes are quite standardized. There is some variability. I would suggest that a lot of the variability takes place after the Egyptians are gone and they're no longer regulating the measures, because they keep making those jars because they're quite useful. Mm-hmm. So these jars are Egyptian jars, and that when you find them in the settlements in the hill country, they're not necessarily the fossil director of Israelite settlement. They are actually fossil directors of an Egyptian policy of sending veterans to settle in problematic areas to be the eyes and ears of the Egyptian crown. It's a win-win situation for everybody, although there's a bit of danger involved. Part of this has to be the creation of alliances locally. These people are not just going to go in a hostile environment, carte blanche, and figure it's going to be okay. There's got to be a carrot and a stick. The stick is Egyptian power. The carrot is going to be trade agreements. If you produce X quantity of grain, we'll let you market it in the Egyptian center at Afek, for example, or in Beit Shan, or in Tel Dan. And we can make this work together. We're here to help you, kind of thing. And if you don't want to be helped, I have friends in the Egyptian garrison. They will make you let me help you, so to speak.
So when these soldiers are going with their families into the hill country and establishing these settlements, where is the entity called, or the people called Israel from the Meneptah Stela at this time? Are they in other areas? I think from based on what you're saying, you're not associating them totally with the rapid emergence of these settlements in the hill country.
I would say that they are there. I would say that none of these political or ethnic entities are necessarily homogeneous. There are always parties in any given polity. And probably the Israelites, if they're living, let's say, in the central hill country, there are Egyptian control centers at places like Afek, Jaffa, Lachish. There's probably interaction with these. And the idea is to maintain sort of an equilibrium and to keep everybody happy. The problem can get sort of nasty when you can't keep people happy. And one of the things that I'm sure Eric Klein also talked about in his podcast with you is that this is a time when there is a climate change phenomenon throughout the ancient Near East, throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, probably worldwide. When the climate gets hotter and drier, there's almost definitely famine. And this creates pressures that change the equilibrium. And it may be that the Egyptians did not have the wherewithal to help out starving farmers who lost their crops. And this created then a kind of rebellion that really caused things to collapse in the end of the day. But I think that to go back to your question, the Israelites were there. The Egyptians established these small homesteads in and around various tribal territories. Probably at the beginning, there was sort of a modus operandi where everybody, you know, agreed to live and let live. There are benefits to having these people around. They help us get to the markets, etc. But at some point, it fell apart.
Have you looked at any other models of this? You mentioned like the Roman mercenary method or the Roman soldier method, where after your term of service, you're granted land, and then it's usually not where you want it. So I'm assuming if you look at past examples, is there's probably similar models, right? Where you have Roman soldiers, and I say quotes because they're probably made up of many different elements, just like you were describing in the Southern Levant. But when they go into these highland areas or these areas that aren't necessarily under total control, how these new elements interact with the people who are already there?
And as I said, I'm looking at the Roman Empire, and that's abundantly clear. For the Egyptians, there's actually some evidence for this. There are documents showing, for example, that Sea Peoples and Libyans are established in Egypt. The Libyans were given lands in the Fayum oasis in Egypt proper, and they were allowed to settle there and to create their own settlements. In the Harris Papyrus, written by Egyptians, we are also told that the Sea Peoples, after a great battle, are settled at the borders of Egypt, either in the Delta or maybe in Sinai, or maybe they're referring to where the Philistines settled later on. And it might be that this is actually part of the Egyptian policy, and it might be that they are referring to the Egyptian professional soldiers and functionaries, not the Egyptians, but the Philistine or foreigners that might be referred to in the Harris Papyrus. So there's actually evidence for the Egyptians doing this themselves. Mm-hmm. Recently, a scholar colleague told me that there's evidence for this happening also in Mesopotamia in the early second millennium BCE, in late Akkad and in the old Babylonian period, that there are also texts talking about how professional soldiers, especially foreigners, are given lands somewhere in the empire, not necessarily in the periphery. So there are examples, not a lot, then. This certainly is something that needs more research.
So my question is, what benefit is it to the peoples who are already populated in that area before these soldiers and their families arrive? What interest is it of these people to interact with these newcomers and not just wipe them out?
Because it almost never works when you try to wipe people out. And if you try to use a heavy hand, force very often is a boomerang. And it's always much better to see if you can make it work and pacify people and give them what they want. As soon as you enter a regime of belligerence, the chances of your being able to actually prosecute what you want to prosecute are small. And you can look at this statistically throughout the human history. It's always better to get people to play along for both sides' mutual benefit rather than to try to oppress and eliminate. Even the Nazis didn't succeed, and look what happened to them. So it's always better to try to do it together.
And you think there's also an element here of, one, that these are professional soldiers, so they would know how to defend themselves and they would be armed, but also they're marrying locals. So do you think there's elements of them marrying into families of people who are already in those highland areas?
I would guess yes. And again, this is pure speculation. We have no evidence for that actually happening. However, even in the biblical text, I would suggest that there are hints that this is what's going on and that there are interactions with these kinds of people. When you look, for example, at King David, one of his most important generals is a guy named Uriah the Hittite. What is a Hittite doing in David's army? And he's sent to the front because David covets his wife, Bathsheba. And so this indicates that this Hittite guy marries a local woman who David wants. But this is a pattern that might be reflecting things that already exist earlier on. Mm-hmm. There are several other examples. Hittites seem to play a role. When the cave of Machpelah, outside Kiryat Arba, where the patriarchs are buried, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it is purchased from a Hittite. Again, what is a Hittite doing in the hill country of Judah? The text is telling us there are foreigners already living here. They are burying their dead here, which means they've been here for a while. The tomb is a symbol of territory, establishment. We live here. We're burying our dead here. It is ours. And the text also says that Abraham purchases the tomb with a deed. It's all legal. The writer is very careful to tell us this is a legal deed, and this was bought from somebody who is a foreigner and still identified as a foreigner, and he is legitimately here. In other words, we as foreigners are also legitimately here, and we bought this tomb plot legally.
And I guess the next stage in this is the Egyptians leave. And what happens to these people then that have been given land by the Egyptians and they're establishing these settlements in the hill country?
So when you hear the Egyptians left, they withdrew. They withdrew because there was chaos in Egypt. It was no longer tenable to maintain a hold in Canaan because these forts couldn't be supplied. There weren't any forces to send north. If there was going to be rebellion, and they were plenty, you couldn't afford to send the army up north because you needed the army back in Egypt to protect your own holdings. The crown was threatened. Ramses III, there was an attempted assassination. He survived it, but he died very soon after that, probably from his wounds. And then there's a rapid succession of kings, one after the other. And eventually the dynasty collapses. This is the 20th dynasty by now. It collapses. And then things sort of re-coalesce once again. But this is after the Egyptians have left their holdings in Canaan, in the Levant, because they could no longer hold them. So what happens to the people that are left behind? First of all, we have to remember that when we say that the Egyptians withdrew, for the most part, this was probably in name, because there probably weren't that many Egyptians living in Canaan who had somewhere to go back home to. There were probably some, and probably those picked up and left. But even the Egyptians that served the crown in Canaan, they had also married local women. I mean, these are all men who have married local women. And so for the most part, if they've consolidated their control over a particular region, over a town, if they have connections with the locals and they're doing just fine, there's probably no reason to go back to the turmoil that is Egypt at the end of the 19th dynasty or 20th dynasty, excuse me. They are going to stay put. And the same holds true for the Aegeans that were in Israel, for the Libyans, for the Syrians that were, and the Hittites that were resident. They maintained some of their old identities, their ethnic identities, in the same way that we do today, but they stayed put. Their home was Canaan and their town where they were established, and they made a go of it. They banded together. They made new alliances with local neighbors, towns, tribes, to try to consolidate control and stay safe. It didn't always work. And this is why in the early Iron Age settlements, we see very often destruction layers or abandonments, because this is a time of turmoil. So you had to make do. There's one other thing that happens now too. The entire ancient Near East, the entire Eastern Mediterranean basin is in chaos. All the empires have collapsed. There's piracy on the high seas. The pirates attack coastal cities, destroy them, plunder them. It's in the texts. We find texts from Ugarit, from Cyprus, from Egypt, telling us that this is a time of turmoil and things are not secure. It's quite possible that, let's say, the erstwhile Aegeans, Danuna, who served at Tel Dan, for example, maintained contacts with their families over generations. And when there was chaos, let's say, on the coast of Turkey and pirates plundering the cities, it may be that the Danuna living in Tel Dan, which may have been called Laish at the time, communicated with their families and said, you should come here. We can use you. We're established. We have good land, plenty of water. We have a military force, but we need more people. Come here with your families. Come and join me here. We can make a good life here. You have nothing left there. So my guess is that when we look at the reliefs, for example, in the temple, the mortuary temple of Ramses III, we see not just battles on the sea, we see refugees, immigrants coming in ox carts, men, women, children, and their goods, they're coming south. This is something that Asaf Yasur Landau pointed out. It's not just battles and war, it's also refugees. These people were invited by their brethren, according to my hypothesis, to settle in places where they were already established.
And you mentioned that a lot of these people held on to their ethnic identities, and you touched on the Denyen or the Danunai in the north. Before we get to them, I'd like if you can also touch on some other evidence we see in that in the text, primarily with the Levites.
So the Levites are a different story, and we're not exactly clear about them yet. They're fascinating. I think we're getting closer to the truth, the people that are writing about these things. Richard Friedman, for example, the biblical scholar, has a lot about this now. The Levites, when you look at their names in the biblical text, they all have Egyptian names. You know, Phineas and Osnat and people like that. Moses is an Egyptian name. It's Mes, the suffix, which means son of. Miriam probably is Miriamu, the beloved of the god Amun. So the Levites are Egyptian in some way or form. What exactly their role is and how they reached the land of Israel is another question. In the book of Numbers, when there's a census of all the Israelite tribes by tribe, the book actually says we did not count the Levites. You know, what is that about? I don't, we don't know, but there's something different about them. And there's something Egyptian about them. One theory is that the Israelites had a component of Egyptians who were religious, progressives, rebels, who had formed a new religion. Perhaps this goes back to Akhenaten and Atenism in the 14th century, and that perhaps that maintained in Egypt through the 13th and 12th centuries, and eventually they were sort of like the pilgrims coming to Plymouth, where they left the homeland in search of religious freedom and in search of their religious beliefs, and established themselves amongst this chaos and this lack of Egyptian control in erstwhile Egyptian centers, and they became perhaps the driving religious force, setting the tone for a new religion that eventually became Yahwehism. It's one theory. It's a fairly radical theory. Whatever the truth is, there were definitely Levites that have an Egyptian connection that had a very important religious role to play in what later became both Israel and Judah. Mm-hmm. By the way, at Tel Dan, you know, it's the only site that we have these hundreds of Egyptian cooking pots. And I just wonder, speculatively thinking, whether there's something like these Levites that maybe settled at this erstwhile Egyptian settlement at the foot of Mount Hermon, where the source of the Jordan River is located, including Egyptian women who manufactured and cooked in the Egyptian way.
And when we're looking at Tel Dan and the people there and then their eventual incorporation into what would be known as the tribe of Dan of the Israelites, what are some examples of very clear Greek cultural influence that we see in the stories also that we're looking at, whether it's Samson or others?
Well, so we talked about the fact that there are these Aegean Ashdoda type heads of figurines, like we find in Philistia at the same time period. You know, what are they doing way up north of Tel Dan? They are a variant of the Egyptian religionists who are worshiping a female goddess who may be related to fertility. So there's that. There are also the story of Dan in itself has several interesting connections in that regard. So as the name suggests, Dan probably is a variant of the word Danyen Danuna. And in Greek mythology, this is a group of people called the Danae. Perseus is a Danae. Now, you may recall that the Danites initially have, in the Bible, have their settlement area in the coastal plain area north of the Philistines and to the west up to the area of Beit Shemesh on the way to Jerusalem. That is the Danite inheritance, and that's where the Samson stories take place. Coincidentally, some of the stories with Perseus and Andromeda take place in Jaffa, in that same area, right next to where the Dan inheritance is. That's probably not a coincidence. The stories of Samson also. Samson is this judge who is unlike any other Israelite hero. His main characteristic is his massive strength. He has long hair. He's called a Nazarite. We're not exactly sure what that means. He has lots of Philistine friends. They hang out together. And he falls in love with a Philistine woman whose name is Delilah. Samson does things like tells riddles. And all of these features are completely foreign to the Israelites in the Hebrew Bible. None of the judges look anything like this with this massive strength. His name also is weird. His name means little son. It's sort of like, you know, Apollo or something like that. You wouldn't expect a name like that in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. This was already noted way back in the 60s by Michael Astor and Yigal Yadin, who both wrote articles and books at exactly the same year, 1964, I believe, was that it looks like Samson is actually a Greek hero, like Hercules or something like that. And this suggests that the Danites themselves are something somewhat foreign who are later inducted into the tribes of Israel. There are other evidences of this. For example, in the Song of Deborah, the beginning of the book of Judges, when the song talks about the roles of the different tribes in the battle against the Canaanites, the tribe of Dan is noted as staying by the sea in their ships. What Israelite tribe has ships? So that's another indication that something's different about these Danites. And I think now many scholars accept the idea that they are foreigners. They came from across the sea. They established themselves and later were included into the tribes of Israel. Now, some people will then look at the biblical text and say, wait a second. When the tribes of Israel are counted in the desert in the 40 years of wandering, the tribe of Dan is one of them. How can they have arrived afterwards if they're already counted in the book of Numbers? That doesn't work. And my answer to that is, you'll have to figure that one out for yourself.
Mm-hmm. We've established that we have all these different groups that eventually became affiliated with Israel or identified with this Israelite entity that we know was already there. Why did, in your opinion, I know you have to speculate on this, but why did the Israelite identity win out as opposed to something else?
I think that it's a process. I mean, this took many decades, maybe more than 100 years, but eventually, a lot of times ethnic identity is coalesced around the way others perceive you. In other words, if you are a small group on your own, you're vulnerable. So it's a good idea to hook up with others, and over time you form into something else. You share identities, you hybridize, and you become something else. But also another thing which helps an ethnic identity crystallize when you have a common enemy. And in the early Iron Age, there was at least one of those, and these were the Philistines. They were the big demons down the slope. I would imagine that various tribal entities, together with these small colonies established by the Egyptians, eventually banded together. There was lots of intermarrying going on anyway, and they banded together against the common enemy in the lowlands, which were the Philistines, who were most probably making incursions up into the hill country, trying to take the lands of the hill country and incorporate its agrarian resources. There were also other enemies to the south. You would have had the Amalekites, you had the Moabites and the Ammonites to the east, the Arameans to the north. There were lots of enemies, and for these small tribal groups, it just wouldn't work to stand by yourself. You would try to be independent and unconnected and uncommitted to other groups, but in the end, if the enemy's stronger, you're going to have to seek out alliances. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that people maintained tribal alliances in their tribal territories, but they banded together out of expediency. And eventually, that led to a territorial kingdom, the kingdom of Israel.
And in terms of the Israelite identity, it's because you think there was already this entity there or this people there that from the Meneptah stone were apparently something to be reckoned with and had some power.
They must have had a dominating influence on this coalition of groups. And it may also well be that they were the first ones to form a kingship. I mean, this whole story of why we need a king that Samuel raises, you know, the Israelites clamor for a king, and Samuel, I can anoint a king, but here are the minuses of having a king. There's a downside. And the Israelites decide they want one anyway. And then Saul is chosen as the king. Now, Saul is a guy that comes out of Benjamin, which is another tribe, and they have their own story. But the sense is that the Israelites were the most powerful entity. The first king was probably associated with them and their power, being the dominant entity. And probably there was a conscious effort on the part of that dominant entity to bring the others into the entity and to make them more committed and more a part of the ethnos.
What's been the reaction by your contemporaries to your thesis?
So first of all, I've published it recently in a couple of places, and it's not published yet as a standalone article thesis. So I presented it at talks, presented it in articles as part of a bigger picture of things. It's in the final volume of the Tel Dan excavations, Dan 4, which talks about the early Iron Age remains. But in order to get more substantial reaction, this has to come out as a standalone article or a book. So far, when I presented at conferences, I get the reaction of, wow, that makes sense. Why didn't we think about that? And every couple of weeks, I get a letter, you know, has this published yet? Is this published yet? I send people to the article in the new Social Archaeology of the Levant volume that just came out from Cambridge University Press, published by Eric Klein and Asafia Sirlando and York Rowan. My article in there on the early Iron Age in the Hill Country contains this thesis. But again, so far, it's all positive. I've got nobody writing or saying anything like, nah, this doesn't work. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens to some of the more conservative scholars and what their take is on it. There will be the ones that I will expect I'll get some pushback from. Mm-hmm.
But up until now, you haven't gotten any teasers to what's going to happen once your thesis is in writing?
So far, you know, I've given the talk at two academic meetings. You saw the one at the University of Chicago. There were plenty of senior scholars there. Everybody is in favor so far.
Interesting.
And remember, you know, I am not presenting something that is the explanation for everything. I'm saying this is a core reason for the settlement phenomenon. Afterwards, I'm sure there's more settlement that isn't connected to the Egyptian crown, especially when the Egyptians leave. Then there's a lot more settlement, which is probably a knock-along factor from those that already existed in the hill country.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I hear your thesis is that you're not suggesting this is a total replacement theory. It's a component that plays into everything else going on here.
Yeah, and I would also say it is the catalyst for the hill country settlement, permanent settlement. There were Israelites in the hill country. They had their own kinds of settlements. Maybe they lived mostly in tents. I don't know. There were also refugees. There were people escaping the lowlands, especially with rebellion, the Egyptians making incursions and setting fire to settlements. So there's a refugee population that comes and settles also. This is one component. I would suggest this is the catalyst of permanent settlement in the hill country.
Just to wrap up here, why do you think the subject of the origins of ancient Israel has just continued to occupy people's minds? Why don't we care about, I mean, I know we care about it, but why does this take such a central place in Near Eastern archaeology and people's interests in general, including mine?
I actually think that the interests have died down in the last few decades, partly for political reasons. And that is the Central Hill Country is where the modern political conflict is centered. You have the Israeli settlers who are resettling the ancient biblical land of Israel, because that's where Israel mostly lived. Then you have the Palestinians that have been there for thousands of years, many of whom themselves are descendants of the ancient Israelites. So it's very entangled and political and angry. Israelis can no longer dig really in the hill country anymore, and it needs more research, but it's now held largely by the Palestinians or by settler populations. And if you go to dig in either one of those places, either you can't or you become political. Mm-hmm. And so most archaeologists have backed away from this whole thing of doing in-the-field research on the Israelite settlement phenomena. So actually, I think that the interest has sort of lowered in the last few decades. I think there might be a resurgence. We have no real new data. You know, all the settlement maps, all the site plans, all the finds that have been published are of things that were excavated 30 years ago and more. So actually, there's sort of a lessening of interest. The general public, of course, is fascinated by this whole idea of the beginnings of ancient Israel because it's this phenomenon, it's this thing that took place 3,000 plus years ago. And here Israel is again, a powerful country in the Middle East, reestablishing its credentials, fighting for its existence. And it seems to play out something that began so long ago. You know, it's like one of the only civilizations that still exist from that long ago. For a lot of people, that's just fascinating.
Well, on a personal level then, and from a professional level with what you've made of what you've turned your life into, dedicating your life to archaeology and the study of the ancient Near East, why is it fascinating to you and why have you continued to focus on it?
Well, one of my weaknesses as a scholar is that I'm all over the place and I don't just do this. I deal with Chalcolithic religion 6,000 years ago and burial practices in the early Bronze and Middle Bronze Age. You know, I'm all over the place. This is not the only thing that occupies my scholarly attention. But the beginnings of Israel is fascinating for me too. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that I live and work in Israel now, and I have since I was 20 years old. But I grew up in the United States. And when you grow up in the United States, you need something else besides your American identity. And most Americans find something else, whether it be a sports team or a club of some sort or a musician that they adore, or you find some kind of religious or ethnic identity. And when I was a kid, I sort of happened upon my Jewish identity. I joined the Zionist youth movement summer camp. You know, I was brainwashed by the whole Zionist thing and had a great time and met lots of girls. Ended up in Israel for that reason. It's an identity thing. And you'll find that there are a number of archaeologists in Israel who either come from the United States, Britain, or the Soviet Union. a much larger percentage than actually exists in the population. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with a search for identity. You know, I'm self-analyzing here, but I have a feeling that that's a large part of it.
Mm-hmm. This has been a fascinating talk, and I would love it if you could please let me know when this does get published and when it is in writing in an actual journal, like you mentioned. I'd love to see that and continue following this argument, this discussion.
All right. I will do that. We're one of the first people to know.
Thanks. And thanks again for taking the time to talk to me. I see on your side, it's already getting dark there. So I'll let you get back to your weekend or beginning of your week, I guess.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay. It's been fun talking.
Take care.
Keep up the good work.